Good morning and welcome to Money Matters. Jennifer Stone filling in today for Dave Pezzo. Phone number is 580-KIDO 580-5436. Today I have a special guest with me and we're going to talk about one of the most important parts of financial planning, which is your estate plan. A lot of times people put that off and you really can't. So we're going to spend a lot of time talking about that. But first, I did want to talk just briefly about the market this week. Wow, what a week, right? Back into the volatility. We had a big down on Friday with the Dow down a little over 3%, but it's still up right about 8% from the low in June. And the S&P was down around 2.6. And again, it also is still up around 10.5% since the middle of June. So even though it feels negative, which we know, it also isn't as bad as you think when you start to dive into those numbers. So I looked at a couple different things as well and thought about out of the 165 trading days this year, 15 or so, we've had up over 2%, 16 down over 2%. That seems pretty volatile, right? But this is what we try to talk about when people think, I can time this. I can get in and out right. How do I do that when out of those days, most of them in June, when we bought them mid-June, happened five of those worst days were in that month. What made it turn around? Nothing. It just did. So sometimes the market just stops falling. So we need to remember to stay invested. Get back to those basics. Look at why you're investing, what your goal is. What are you planning for? Is it retirement? Is it education? What is the objective of those funds? I always say, write it down, create your own investment policy statement on what you're doing with those dollars, and go back to them when the volatility hits. And remember to diversify. I know these are just really brief hints, but I just wanted to go over a couple of them as we're back into seeing some negative days. Diversify. Something tends to be doing okay when other things aren't. And if you don't have a low of lows, it's a little easier for you to stay in and not think about getting out. Because the average investor, you really truly are your own worst enemy when you look at the numbers. You can't even keep up with inflation if you try to zig in and zig out. Everybody had gotten to the point in June because we felt it. Peak of pessimism. You've heard Dave say it over and over and over again. We were there when the market had come down so substantially since the first of the year. Everyone was thinking, oh, this time is different, which it always is. But then all those negative things that we've overcome in the past, we forget about them. So remember, you can't get into this and zig and zag and think that you can time the market. Those best days always happen right almost immediately following the worst. If you think about it, 7 of the 10 best days occurred within 15 days of the 10 worst. How can you time around that? Or you buy and hold, stay fully invested and get about 9.5% on your money over the last 20 years. You miss 30 of those best days and you have no return. So that's what we're saying with this. Make your goal. Make your plan, stick with it, take the emotions out of investing as much as you possibly can, focus on the goal that you're set with those dollars, and keep up and going. It'll work out in the end. All right, so I want to introduce my guest. Her name is Ariana Clapp Youngren, and she's been an attorney for quite some time now. We know her firm that she works with at Sandra Clapp & Associates. They're in Eagle. We've worked with them probably for 20, 25 years or so. They've done great estate planning for most of our clients that we've worked with and referred to them. So I wanted to bring her in and have her help me help you get a great estate plan in order. It's a difficult thing. People don't want to talk about it. They don't want to focus on what happens after they pass. But as we were just sitting here talking and getting ready to go on air, we were talking some stories that she's dealt with, I've dealt with, that could have been so easy to fix and make better if they would have just put that estate plan in place ahead of time instead of triaging it after the fact. So Ariana, first, tell me a little bit about you and why you decided to become an attorney.
Thank you for having me, Jennifer. Well, originally I wanted to go to medical school and I quickly learned that I can't do chemistry. So I started thinking about some of my other skills that I had, and I loved writing and logic problems. And I was double majoring in history and biology. And so I kind of said, you know, I'll go to law school. I also really liked the idea of being able to help women, particularly in certain situations like domestic violence. So that was my original goal, was to go to law school to help women and men in these unfortunate situations. Mm-hmm. I go to law school and I end up falling in love with the field of estate planning, taxation. It was a natural fit. And right out of law school, I was offered the job at Sandra Clapp & Associates, and that is where I've been since. Mm-hmm. Of course, I did volunteer at the WCA and with women's shelters to help adhere to my original goal. But that is a little bit about my background. I've been there for a little over 8 years now, and I love the field. I feel like I do a lot of good, and we really help clients in a variety of situations, whether it's before death or after death, helping their families, helping children or incapacitated adults, being able to navigate the what can be perceived as a difficult or daunting process.
You know, it's interesting because a lot of times people say, well, we're in a community property state. Why would I need to do an estate plan? Everything will pass to my spouse or however that works. But just briefly say, how important is it to have a good estate plan in order?
It is extremely important for a number of different reasons, because every person in every situation is different. If you have minor children or if you have disabled adults or children, it is important to have a will or an outline on who takes over their care if something happens to you. If you have a medical emergency or event where you are unable to direct your own medical care or decisions, if you are unable to take care of your bills or financial affairs, you need powers of attorney in place to direct who steps in instead of you. And in addition, you mentioned, well, I'm married, community property laws will apply, and that's not necessarily the case. Sometimes you have something called separate property, and that would be because of something you bring into the marriage or an inheritance, and separate property is not always transferred to the surviving spouse. It's actually one half to the surviving spouse and one half to any children that you may have. So sometimes these presumptions, these myths of estate planning do not always go the way people assume. Believe or assume they
Correct.
Do.
Correct. Yeah. Assuming is very, very bad. You should never assume things are going to work out just because you've heard it. And we hear that with financial planning all the time, right? Well, so-and-so told me I don't need this because of, or so-and-so told me I don't need to invest in, I don't know, real estate or whatever it might be because I heard from someone. And that's the worst thing we hear too, is don't assume, go to a professional to get the information. So a lot of times, just like the basics, right? Everyone should, even when you first, probably maybe not quite at 18, but when you start having assets, especially when you get married and you start to have children, probably the first thing you should do is a will. Is that correct?
I would say wills and powers of attorney.
Okay.
Most definitely the powers of attorney, because accidents happen. You might be involved in a car accident. You might have a stroke. I have a person as young as 19 under a guardianship right now because this individual was involved in a terrible car accident and he had no powers of attorney in place. So when that happens, we have to go get a guardianship, potentially a conservatorship if there's assets, so that somebody has the legal authority to ensure that there's medical care and or financial decisions that can be made for this person. And so we have many individuals, as I mentioned, as young as 19, all the way into their 90s, depending on what that situation is. So as soon as somebody turns 18, I always recommend a healthcare power of attorney and a financial power of attorney in the event you are able to take care of those decisions yourself.
Yeah, that's interesting too, because I think parents forget. At 18, you're done. You cannot make decisions for your kids anymore. So you have to have those legal documents put in place. I mean, we didn't think about it until recently. Our kids are older. They're 26 and 21. And we did the same thing. We went, well, we can, they're our kids. We can always take care of our kids, but not anymore once they turn 18.
No, and that's exactly right. The law at 18, and we've even had medical professionals or facilities that even when the child is 17, that they will start deferring to the child and making that transition from the parent early on. And a lot of times we have disabled children, children with developmental disabilities, that the parent always assumes that they'll be able to take care of the child. And they don't realize that when that child turns 18, they need a guardianship in place. Oftentimes these children with developmental disabilities cannot sign a power of attorney, whether physically or because they don't understand what they're entering into. And so at that phase, we do look at guardianships, a specific type of guardianship for that disabled child. But powers of attorney, I feel like, are just as important as a will, and you want to make sure you have both. There was a statistic that came out several years ago that it was only 63% of people with estate plans actually have a complete estate plan, meaning they have a will, they have a financial power of attorney, and a healthcare power of attorney. So oftentimes we'll get clients that come in and they're missing one power of attorney, not realizing that they need another.
Wow. You know, it's scary, too, because we'll have to share that story that you were talking about, too. Let's talk a little bit about wills and how you can appoint guardians for kids inside of those and how the fights come if you don't. I want you to share a little bit of that story you were sharing on the break. But first, we're going to take a break. And obviously, we're open for phone calls if you'd like, 580-KIDO, 580-5436. Or you can email me, jstone@petsofinancial.net. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to Money Matters. Jennifer Stone filling in today for Dave Pezzo. Phone number is 580-KIDO, 580-5436. And if you prefer email, that's perfectly fine too. I will check it periodically, jstone@petsofinancial.net. Today, we are covering all things we can think of on the estate plan and how important that is as your overall financial planning picture. More to it than just the market, more to it than just the dollars. You have to make sure this is in order. So I brought in an expert, Ariana Klapp Youngren. She's with Sandra Klapps and Associates. We've worked with them for years, and they do great planning for our clients. So we wanted them to come in and share some of the most important things you can do to get your estate in order. You know, one thing, not even on the financial side, is if you have kids and something tragically happens to both of you, you want to make the decision of what happens with that child. Ariana was sharing a story of a case that she worked on and how difficult it was for a young lady that dealt with both of her parents passing. So I'm going to have her share a little bit about how important it is and what you need to do to make sure that's done. It's not difficult at all.
No, it's not, Jennifer. And the Idaho code or our statutes are going to look to the designation or the nomination a parent puts in a will, which is why it is so important to have a will and defer a guardianship nomination in the event something happens to you, whether you become incapacitated or you die. And in the story I was sharing with Jennifer during one of our breaks is I worked on a case with a young girl who lost both of her parents tragically in the same year. And there was a no will, no guardianship nomination, but a litigation ensued between the family and a non-family member over the custody of this young girl. So not only was she dealing with the loss of two parents, she was trying to go to school, maintain friends, be a child, and yet she was drawn into this litigation between two opposing sides, and it wasn't fair for her. And of course, it was a tragedy for her, but if there had been this guardianship nomination in the will, our statutes in Idaho say that guardianship nomination takes top priority. And it is a very clear-cut decision for the court in that scenario. In the case I just mentioned, the court has to decide, and he or she knows nothing about the background, the parties, what the parents would have wanted. And the court has to make a decision on what he or she thinks is best for this child. And that's no position that any judge wants to be put in. And it's just emphasizes the need to have these wills designating who will be that guardian. Mm-hmm. And it's not always a good idea to have a couple successors named in the event that guardian is too old or doesn't feel like they can take that role on.
So in that case, that the child was probably in foster care until they found a placement, or did she get to be with her family?
They were not. There is a process called temporary guardianship.
Okay, good.
Where basically we need a guardianship now, and we can't wait till the final hearing. So there was a temporary guardianship in place while litigation was pending.
Okay. Isn't that terrible, though, to think about that, right? So now she has such an unsettled life. It's already going through everything else, and kids need consistency. My husband works in juvenile corrections, and he knows how important that is for children to be functioning correctly. And a lot of that comes from a clear, consistent secure environment. And with that, you're putting her in a place that she should never have to be in.
That is exactly right. And for this young minor, she was unsettled during the entire school year because she didn't know, do I stay here or will I be leaving? Mm-hmm. And so that put an immense amount of stress on her in addition to processing grief.
Yeah.
So if we had known what the direction should have been in advance, it would have been a much more expedient process, and mm-hmm. she could have worked on adjusting and resettling into that new life rather mm-hmm. than waiting a year as we went through litigation in that case.
Yeah. And so in situations, I mean, if someone like today, they decide, you know what, I need to do this, I've not gotten these forms in place, is it okay? And I know everyone needs to go have everything reviewed by a qualified attorney. That's a no-brainer. You need to make sure those things are in place. But if you don't have the time or you can't get it done, just doing something brief, can you do a handwritten will? Can you type something up and get it notarized and have it there just until you can get the full legal forms done?
Jennifer, I'm glad you brought that up because there are two types of wills that Idaho recognizes. One is called a holographic will, which is a handwritten will that is signed and dated. And in order to be a valid holographic will, it needs to be in your handwriting. So you cannot type it and sign it. Okay. You need to write it out okay. in your handwriting, sign it, date it. If you have it notarized, all the more better. But at least that is something to write down some instructions and your intent, and it's better than nothing.
Okay.
The
okay.
other type of will is a will that is witnessed by two witnesses and a notary. So that one can be typed
okay.
and is also called self-proving, meaning it is presumed valid.
Okay, good. Because see, that's the one thing too. If you just get something down, just get something done. Just get started, and then you can go through and get those power of attorneys, the medical power of attorney. All of that is very important, almost as important as a will, as you say, as you're talking this through. But let's get something down today. Even if you go through LegalZoom, I don't care what it takes. Just get something down and get it witnessed, because that's important, right? Get it notarized. Don't forget those two witnesses, but use the professionals. We have so many more topics to cover, but you can hear the music, so we do need to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit more about the misunderstandings when it comes to full estate planning, probate, non-probate, what overrides what. So beneficiaries, is a will good enough? Those are all the topics we're going to cover next hour, but give us a call. We'd love to talk to you if you have questions. 580-5436, 580-KIDO, jstone@petsofinancial.net. Good morning. Jennifer Stone filling in for Dave Petso this morning. Joining me today to talk about everything estate planning is Ariana Clapp Youngren. She's with Sandra Clapp and Associates in Eagle. I've known the firm for several years now, and we feel they're very good at what they do. So I wanted her to share her expertise because they see so many things. We see a lot of good and bad with estate planning. The bad is when it's not done. The good is when it's all lined out exactly as people would like. Things as simple as make sure titling is correct. Titling, you can pass so much through titling. You can pass so many things without going through probate with using beneficiaries. But before I step too much into that, I want to talk a little bit about first what the probate process is like in Idaho and what things tend to be probated and what things aren't. What does probate look like in Idaho?
So, Jennifer, we have two types of probate processes. We have an informal probate and we have a formal probate. An informal probate is where we can submit a will, or if there's no will, somebody dies intestate, then we can submit an application. And if the person applying has priority under our statutes, or if they're named in the will as the executor or personal representative, then they can apply with the court via this application, submit the original will, has to be the original will, and any codicils or amendments to that document. Then the court, in between the court's busy calendar, will review the application, and if everything is in order, the court will issue letters testamentary or administration if there's no will, and essentially a court order appointing that person as the personal representative. There's no hearing, there's no advance notice, and depending on the county, this process can take between 1 to 3 days. So it's actually quite an expedient informal process.
Okay.
the formal process is perhaps we do not have priority. Somebody is petitioning that doesn't have priority, or perhaps there are issues with the document where we know the court is not going to issue an informal order. So in that scenario, we have to formally petition the court, meaning that we file the petition, the request, any applicable documents, and then we have to set notice and a hearing. And then we hope that there's no objection or other issue, and that at that hearing, the court will appoint us. And depending on each court's calendar, it could be up to 3 months before we can get a hearing. So those are the two different types of processes in Idaho.
Okay, so probate basically... the whole purpose is to assign who's the right to act on the estate, correct? That's what probate really does, is you go through to make sure there's no debts against the estate and you assign that person to handle it?
That is correct. So we have somebody called a personal representative. In other states, known as executor or executrix, that person is the one in charge to administer the assets, to make sure that debts are paid and satisfied, and to ultimately distribute the assets to the heirs. This person also has the authority to sell property or other tangibles. Now, of course, if there is a will, they have to follow the instructions laid out in that document. Mm-hmm. But probate is to cover assets that fall under your will. Now, you mentioned earlier that there are assets that may not fall out mm-hmm. because they pass by beneficiary designation or other title transfers. Mm-hmm. So if those titles are structured appropriately, they do not fall under your probatable estate.
Okay. So we had a situation recently where an executor of the estate requested the beneficiaries on an IRA. And we, based on what we knew and based on the custodian's direction, said, well, we can't release that information to you because it's not a part of the estate. It passed by direct beneficiary to those people, and they had to release that information if they chose to. But the executor felt that he needed to know everything about everything and that he acted on behalf of the deceased person in every aspect of her life. And we felt like he was incorrect. So is it correct that the executor only needs to know things that are a part of the estate, not things that pass by titling?
I love this question because it is a topic that has come up on our attorney listserv and has been something that estate planning attorneys in Idaho have gone back and forth. So you may actually find attorneys on both sides of this issue. Mm-hmm. So some attorneys will take the position that as a personal representative, as somebody stepping in place of the decedent's shoes, that they should be able to know the information about probate assets as well as non-probate assets such as IRAs, life insurance. Mm-hmm. However, in my experience, what you are describing has been what I have seen in my practice, where the named beneficiary to a non-probate asset is the only person entitled to that information. And our probate code is to address primarily the probatable assets under the estate and not to address life insurance or IRAs. Mm-hmm. So what you're describing is what I have seen with other institutions and mm-hmm. in my practice. And if I had a client that came to me saying, I can't get this information, it's
what can you
it's
do?
Too bad, so sad.
Right,
you don't have control over that asset.
Right. Okay. Yeah. It was interesting because it is. It's amazing to me how titling can change everything. I have another person that I've worked with for a long time, and he doesn't have family. He doesn't have direct heirs that he would like to leave everything to. So he's chosen to name his estate as or not put anything on his account. Well, those handle differently too. People don't realize if you name your estate, that's naming something. If you don't, it passes by the plan document of that IRA account, which could be a long lost relative you've never met before. But going into the estate, there's big tax consequences if you pass that through. And if you don't have a will, it becomes very, very messy, even though they think they're fine because they don't have anyone. But they're going to give a lot up to taxes. Is that correct?
That is correct, Jennifer. So, and you've probably discussed this before, where if you have a tax-deferred account and the estate is the named beneficiary or the default beneficiary, the estate is not a recognized entity to receive required minimum distributions on that tax-deferred account. So oftentimes what will happen is it'll accelerate all of the deferred income taxes, and then it is taxed under the estate and trust tax bracket, which is a condensed trust bracket. So oftentimes we see more taxes, more income taxes owed in that scenario,
right,
for tax-deferred accounts. And then, of course, we have the result of where does the remaining money go? Mm-hmm. And Idaho has what's called the laws of intestacy, and they follow something called the table of consanguinity. And it's the law trying to predict where somebody would want their assets to go. So, of course, there's, if you have a spouse, if it's community property, it goes to the spouse. But if it's separate property, as I mentioned earlier, it goes half to the spouse, half to kids. Well, what happens if you don't have spouse? What if you don't have children? Well, then the law is going to predict and say, well, maybe it should go to your parents. Mm-hmm. If you don't have parents that are alive, then where does it go?
Where does it go? Yeah.
So then it's going to go out to your brothers and sisters, then down to nieces and nephews. And if there is a deceased person in a class of individuals, then it gets passed down to his or her living descendants. So we have had these intestacy cases where we'll have upwards of 42 to 50 heirs.
Wow.
That we have to track down, we have to keep tabs on, we have to notify them. And in the end, they're getting less than 1% because of how much the estate has broken down through that table of consanguinity.
Mm-hmm. Isn't it just easier to put beneficiaries on things?
Much easier.
And it's interesting because the one thing, check after this, again, I'm trying to push everybody to make immediate action, because if you do it today when we're talking about it, it will get done. Log into your 401k account and look and see who you have named as beneficiaries. If you've named your spouse, perfect. Then the next step down, put contingents on there. We have seen spouses either pass at the same time or really quickly within time of each other, and they don't get those named beneficiaries, and then it goes by the default document again. So put a contingent on there. It can be changed at any time. These are very simple things to change. Check with your financial advisor if you're using one. Make sure you have your correct beneficiaries. And even if originally you say, oh, I know I set that up, double check it. Things happen. Computers drop off information. Double check this frequently. Pull out your will. Look at it occasionally and see if maybe the custodian or guardian you had for your kids isn't who you want anymore. Double check this information as frequently as you can to make sure it's still what you want. But get beneficiaries on your accounts. It's so super important.
I do agree. And I will add that be careful with minor beneficiaries. You may name your spouse as that primary beneficiary, and we'll see clients name their minor children as the contingent beneficiaries because, of course, we would want our assets to pass down to our kids, or many people do. The problem is children who are minors cannot legally inherit, so you have to ensure that there is a structure in place to make sure that somebody either manages those assets on their behalf. Some financial institutions will serve as the custodian for the minor child, or if you have a proper estate plan that has trusts for these minor children, then you can designate those children's trusts for those assets to flow into, and then your nominated representative for that child can manage those, that IRA or that life insurance for that child.
Mm-hmm. Very good point. You know, it's interesting. Just recently, the documents that we use on accounts we open has a place where you can even designate the person to be the custodian. So they're starting to get more proactive, because a very good point. What do you do when these kids don't have anyone to help them? Back to that, getting a good estate plan in order.
It is. And what we have seen is if you name a minor child and they do not designate a custodian, or it doesn't flow through a child's trust that you create, then we have seen financial institutions require that the surviving spouse or the new guardian for the child be appointed as the conservator through the court before they can receive that payout or that distribution. Mm-hmm. So it just adds another headache to the process that is unnecessary. And from a cost standpoint, it is much cheaper to set this up in advance rather than having to go through a guardianship or conservatorship proceeding mm-hmm. through the court. It is long. It is expensive.
So a question on that. It used to be nobody wanted trusts to be named beneficiaries because of the way the taxation worked on that. So now with these type of trusts, there must be like a pass-through, so it's taxed to the child. They can't stretch anymore because they took those rules away, except I guess there is a rule now that until you're 18, you can stretch it over your life, and then it's 10 years after that, correct?
That is correct. Once the child turns 18, you have 10 years under the new SECURE Act to be able to take required minimum distributions. So some clients will take everything all at once, and then they're taxed all at once, mm-hmm. but you can stretch it for 10 years as a child. There is an exception for surviving spouses, but under the new SECURE Act, you can take 10 years of distributions. You can dole it out. You can take it 1/10 every year.
So is it they can wait till they're 18 to start the first distribution, or do they have to take a little bit out until they're 18?
They can wait till they're 18.
Okay.
As long as they take it out by age 28.
Okay.
So that time period starts ticking at age 28.
Okay.
And we build in these, we call it this kind of this retirement clause in mm-hmm. these children's trusts to be able to take those required minimum distributions. And what that means is if the trustee selects, the RMD can get paid through the child's trust. And the trustee at that time can elect to keep the required minimum distribution inside the child's trust, meaning that it will be taxed under the trust, or it can be paid out directly as a pass-through trust, and then the child would report it on his or her tax return.
Okay. The reason why is there's different tax treatments for entities versus individuals. And entities always tend to be more heavily taxed than individuals do. So that's why we always want to check to be sure there's that pass-through ability so that if you want to be able to do so, you can. All right, we're going to take a quick break, and we're going to talk more about estate planning when we get back. But please give us a call, 580-KIDO, 580-5436. Good morning. Welcome back to Money Matters. Jennifer Stone filling in for Dave Petso today, 580-KIDO, 580-5436. If you have your questions lined up to talk about on this estate planning thing, this is a perfect time to get a little bit of advice from an expert, Ariana Clapp-Youngren. She's with Sander Clapp & Associates. Give us a call. Shoot me an email. We'd love to answer some questions if you have any that have come up during the conversations we've been having. All right, let's jump right back into a couple things. Homes, that's a big deal in Idaho. Almost every other thing you can use a titling, you can put a beneficiary on. And I don't let me forget, I want to ask you about small estate affidavits too, okay? So when you look at this and you say the only asset that you really can't pass by titling is a home, is that correct?
That is correct, except to between spouses. So spouses can pass the home to between each other. It has to have community property with rights of survivorship on the deed. And what happens then is when a spouse dies, we record a death certificate in the county where the real property is held, and the decedent's interest in the home passes to the survivor as a matter of right. This is something that is only permitted between spouses, and it has to be that specific language, community property with rights of survivorship. I have seen clients who try to add a child to their home, mm-hmm. which brings up a lot of concern and problems. And when they think that by adding the child to the home, they're avoiding probate. Mm-hmm. It does not, because as if the home is in your name, then the home is one of the biggest reasons we probate estates. And if the home is in your name and the child's name, we still have to probate to deal with your interest. Nobody is authorized to sign a deed or transfer that title until they have the authority vested by the court through the probate system.
Okay.
So one of the myths that we see or misconceptions is the will says, I get mm-hmm. the home, so it's mine. And that's true. Yes, that is their intent, but you have to go through that legal step of transferring it. Mm-hmm. And sometimes if it's spouses, that can be a death certificate if it has the language on the deed that I mentioned. But if it's anybody else, then you need to go through the probate process so you have that legal authority to transfer that asset. Mm-hmm. I can't transfer your home. You can't transfer my home.
Which you don't want.
And I don't want. And even when I die, somebody cannot come in and transfer my home until the court gives them that authority. So mm-hmm. those are some of the two biggest misconceptions I see, is assuming certain transfers are automatic and assuming that because the will says X gets the property or a certain asset, that the transfer is automatic and it just happens.
Mm-hmm. I guess it's kind of this way too. You think about, just because there's a document that says you get something, you still have to change ownership always in any way. We went through a situation with, I'll just share with my father who passed. He didn't really own much because he was kind of a simple person. He had some cash. His estate was under $100,000 because he didn't have a lot, didn't own a home, nothing. So we were able to get that done without probate through the small estate affidavit. But that's kind of something that makes some things a little bit simpler than people think they can be, right?
Yes. Yeah, so the Idaho recognizes a small estate affidavit, which is extremely beneficial for smaller estates. The small estate affidavit does not work for real property, meaning if you own a home or a lot. So this is primarily for tangible property, vehicles, mm-hmm. or accounts that do not pass by a beneficiary designation. So if we have somebody that maybe has $15,000 in a savings account and a vehicle, the small estate affidavit is a fantastic option because it allows somebody to claim and get access to that asset without having to go through the probate process. It doesn't solve all of the problems that probate provides, such as a notice to creditors or having a legal forum to wrap things up. But it does at least provide access to those assets. I will mention to be conscientious of certain financial institutions with regard to these small estate affidavits, because we have seen certain banks push back on these small estate affidavits because the statute says as long as the estate is under $100,000, you should be able to use one of these affidavits to collect on the assets. Mm-hmm. We have run into banks or other financial institutions that will cap it, and they will not recognize these small estate affidavits or turn the money over and will require a probate. So we had a situation where the person had about $22,000 in a savings account, but this bank would not recognize the small estate affidavit if the account exceeded 20.
Oh.
So we had to do a probate. Whereas if that account was at any other financial institution, they would have recognized that small estate affidavit.
Gotcha.
So I always warn clients, be careful. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Banks are changing their internal policies because it is a lot of liability for them to recognize these small estate affidavits.
Yeah, because how do they verify it's legit? How do they know there's not more assets out there? How can they prove it, right?
That is correct, because they don't. And they are relying on the person presenting this affidavit that they are the appropriate person mm-hmm. to receive the assets, whereas they may not be. The decedent's will may have appointed a son, and the surviving spouse could be making an application for this bank account mm-hmm. that she's technically not entitled to.
Right.
So we've been seeing banks push back for that reason so that they reduce their risk.
Gotcha. Which brings up a good point, too. If there's an individually titled account, even if you're married, that account has to be proven that it goes to the surviving spouse. So that's why you're saying that would have to go through the decedent's estate. That can't just be given to the spouse because they're married.
That's correct. If the spouse is not a joint owner, mm-hmm. rights of survivorship, or is not a named beneficiary to that account, then that account will pass through probate and the decedent's will or intestacy. Mm-hmm. I had a situation just this week that arose where we have an individual who has a fairly large bank account, so a small estate affidavit will not work. The account is sourced from inheritance, which is separate property.
Mm-hmm.
She never added her spouse to the account. He is not a named beneficiary. And she titled the account as her sole and separate property. So this account is not going to pass 100% to her spouse once he goes through the probate process. Mm-hmm. It will pass half to him and half to their children.
Yeah. Yeah. See, it's interesting, isn't it? You really need to know when you're titling what it means. It is easy to be in a community property state. Of course it is, but that doesn't take away the titling. And that's another thing people need to know too. You can put beneficiaries on almost anything. You can put beneficiaries on your bank account. You can put it on your investment account that's just registered in your name or jointly with spouses. There's a lot of ways you can title assets to avoid going through probate if that's a concern of yours. But I had a conversation with your office once that talked about that. It says if you do a, because we see a lot of trusts being sold and sometimes oversold. People come in with trusts when they don't need them, or they paid $6,000 to $10,000 and the only thing that's going to go into it is their house. So there was a time when we saw so many trusts being pushed that we went, we don't even want to talk trust, because it seemed like most of these people were almost being taken advantage of. And so they said that one lady actually came in and told me she went into an office for an appointment, sat down, and they turned on a TV that said the horrors of probate. And I'm like, well, wow. They know nothing about you. How can they put that up without knowing anything about your situation and say you need a trust? You don't know that until you've fact found and you figure out what they need, just like with us. I can't tell you how to invest your money until I know what you're doing. I don't put up a video about how you can be worth $1 million without knowing what your goals are. So we had seen a lot of that for a while. And then I talked to your office and I said, I don't want to live in, we like to say, an echo chamber of only what agrees with me of saying no trust, never, right? So tell me the difference between going through probate and going and having a trust. And it was really easily explained. If you do a trust, you may have to pay upfront more than you would with just a will. You will, because it's more costly, more cumbersome. Or you wait till you pass and then the executor of your estate pays to settle your estate. And the costs really aren't that different if they're done properly and not overly cumbersome. Is that correct?
That is my experience, Jennifer, is a will is more simplistic. There is not as much to set up, but it oftentimes requires probate. So then we have to pay to do a probate administration and a court filing fee. And so the offset, if somebody is looking between the two of them for a purely cost perspective, I don't think that is a reasonable goal because they will be paying it on the back end. The trust is more to set up because there's more documents in place. Mm-hmm. And it is also more legwork to set up because you have to retitle certain accounts or coordinate assets with that trust. So, but the benefit is if it's appropriately structured, you do not have to pay for probate in the end.
Gotcha. All right. We'll talk a little bit more about that, but we do need to take a break. Sometimes it goes so quick and I look at the clock because it's just rolling. So we're going to take a break real quick. Give us a phone call, 580-KIDO, 580-5436. Good morning. Welcome back to Money Matters. Jennifer Stone filling in for Dave Petzo so he can have a nice long weekend. Phone number is 580-KIDO, 580-5436. Would love a phone call. If you have any questions at all, this is the time to ask an expert about your estate plan. And I know she'd be glad to give you some guidance as much as she can with specifics you give. But what we're talking about now, and we kind of ended it a little brief because we needed to take a break. But what I really wanted to talk about a little more detail, if you would like to, is explain the differences again between just having a will take care of everything versus the trust. This is something we talk about all the time, and I'm more open to it. I'm understanding more that maybe people don't want to deal with going through the whole probate process. And some executors, even though it's your pick an appropriate executor, I guess I should say, because some people aren't really capable or an understanding of what to do. So again, usually trustees and executors are the same. But what would be, I guess, when would you look at this and say a trust would fit better than going through probate? Or is it just personal preference?
So one of the first questions when we meet a new client is we outline the difference between a will versus a trust. And we walk them through those basics. This is what a will is. This is the trust, the advantages and the disadvantages. I also start asking questions, or we have an estate planning questionnaire that I will look through in advance to see if there are any indicators that I feel like they would benefit more from a trust. One of the biggest reasons that we will advise our clients to have a trust is if they have real property, a home, land, of any kind outside of the state of Idaho. Because if you have a will, you're not only looking at probating in Idaho, mm-hmm. but you are also looking at probating in those other states. And sometimes I've had estates where we have to probate 3 to 4 different states, which is extremely expensive. And you are subject to the laws in every single state. You have 3 to 4 different attorneys, depending on how many assets you have. Things that you should be aware of are condominium interests. If it is a vested title, be very careful about those, because those can be treated as a real property interest outside of Idaho. You can also have mineral or oil interests, particularly in North Dakota and Kansas. We have seen those. Those are real property interests that require probate to deal with. So when I see clients that have anything like that, then I start talking about a trust, because the trust will become the legal owner of the home that you have here in Idaho and the other property outside of the state. And the trust continues on after your passing because it holds legal title. You have a new trustee come in after your passing, and they will administer those assets. And you can avoid probate not just in Idaho, but also in that other state, so long as everything is structured in the trust appropriately. Mm-hmm. So that is one of the big reasons that I start looking at trusts. Sometimes we don't have that situation, but we have clients that already come in with an existing trust. We have a lot of people moving here where they come in with trusts. They already have assets titled in the trust. So instead of going through the burden of pulling everything out, we will keep that existing structure. Another reason is we have people that come in and they have had experience with trusts, maybe through their parents or another relative, or they have heard through the grapevine that you have to have a trust. And if they do not have that real property outside of Idaho, if they don't have a lot of business interests or rental properties, then if it's just a home and a bank account, I ask the client, you know, really, what's your goal? And sometimes the client's goal is to make it as easy as possible for their children when they die. They do not want them going through the probate process, even after I explain that informal process and how simple it can be. They desire to have the trust appropriately structure and have it managed so that the child can come in as the successor trustee and take over on their passing. So sometimes we will set up trusts because the client would like the simplicity and avoidance of probate. Mm-hmm. But usually once I go through the pros and the cons and I explain the difference for individuals who have a very simplistic plan, I would say about half the time they go with a will and half the time they go with a trust. It really is split down the middle.
Interesting. You know, and that puts it in very clear terms, because a lot of times people say, well, why would a trust, if the people that made the trust, why would that continue after I pass? Because that's kind of an entity. It's not a person. The trust doesn't die. The trustees pass.
That's correct. It's a legal entity. If you think of an LLC or a corporation, just because the CEO of the corporation passes away, the corporation doesn't go away.
Right.
Now, a trust is a little bit different. It's a smaller scale, but a similar concept. It's an entity that continues on after somebody passes away.
Mm-hmm. So we see a lot of people come to us and say, and it's kind of interesting, I went to my attorney, I set up a trust, but none of their accounts are in it. Just because you create something, that doesn't mean everything you own is now in it. You have to go through the retitling process.
That is absolutely correct. And something that good attorneys will emphasize when creating a trust is, if you are going to go this route with a trust, it is appropriate to, number one, fund it, which means retitle the assets, getting the home transferred into the account, going to your bank, getting the bank accounts transferred, and working with your financial advisor to make sure that those investment accounts are structured appropriately. So that's number one. Number two is maintaining it, because things happen. You sell your home, you acquire a new home, or you buy more property, and people will forget that they have this trust that they need to stick that account or that new home into. So we will have clients that we have the trust funded, we have the account structured, we've coordinated with their financial advisor, it looks great, and 5 years later, 10 years later, all the assets are outside of the trust because they've changed things around and they do not maintain it. Mm-hmm. So I emphasize when setting up a trust, you need to be prepared to keep that structure in place, because then and only then will you get the long-term benefit mm-hmm. for your successor trustee and your beneficiaries taking over.
Perfect. It's almost like running a business, right? You got to keep your business going too.
Yes, very much so.
All right, we're going to go to the phones. Good morning, Richard. How can we help you?
Well, I'm involved with a trust, and it was my mother's trust, and her name is on the trust. It was a living trust, and my understanding was that when she died, it became a permanent trust. Now, the issue is trying to change trustees, because the current trustee is old and wants to turn it over to the next generation.
Mm-hmm.
But they're saying that they have to, in order to do it, they have to change the name. In other words, start a different trust in order to change the trustee. Isn't there normally a way to change trustees?
So, Richard, the trust document, we always want to turn to that to see what it states, because you're right. There are times where the nominated successor trustee cannot take over. So they will sign a resignation or a renunciation of that title. So then we look to see who is named next. If there is no named successor trustee in that document, or the person that wants to be the successor trustee in the document is not named, then this is one of those more rare scenarios where we have to file a petition with the court, and that court has to formally appoint that successor trustee. So first I would turn to the document to see who is named next, and if there is no one named next or somebody else wants to take on that role, then there probably needs to be a registration of that trust in the place where that trustee resides and request the court formally appoint them.
So you wouldn't have to start a new trust. It could still remain the trust by the deceased name's title?
From my understanding, if this was your mother's trust and she died and there are no other grantors or creators of the trust alive, most often the trust becomes irrevocable at that point. So nobody has the authority to change it, which is why if there's nobody else named, we would have to have the court approve the next line of trustees.
Yeah, I don't think that you could even put it into a new trust until that one's settled properly. So I'm surprised you're being told that. So yeah, I would check the trust document like Ariane was saying. And then if you're working with someone, have them help you walk through the documents. It's important probably to go back to an attorney on this one.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. Have a great weekend. All right. Yeah, that's an interesting topic, isn't it? It's funny how, and maybe the interchangeable language there was a new trust versus a new trustee. Maybe there was some confusion, because to settle out a trust, you have to have a trustee to do that.
Yes, that is correct. And I will say, we do get a lot of complaints about the legalese in mm-hmm. this field, because every document has a different fiduciary title, and it can be very confusing trying to understand which fiduciary governs which document or certain assets.
Right.
But, you know, the topic that Richard had called in on is, we could spend hours talking about trust administrations and estate administrations through the probate process
mm-hmm.
and all the nuances that come up. And we have different laws, something called TEDRA, which is called the Trust and Dispute Resolution Act, that can help informally resolve disputes, that can help informally resolve certain issues, such as ambiguity in trust documents mm-hmm. or if there is no named successor trustee.
Right.
But again, that's something that, you know, we usually have to get attorney guidance for.
Sure.
Potentially the court involved.
Yeah, because it's too hard to understand the ins and outs of all the laws and how they work. Another thing that comes up all the time, and I don't think we talked on this, but we did talk on break, is the powers for a power of attorney versus a successor trustee. So we'll get clients that call in and say, well, I'm the power of attorney, but they have a trust and they're not the successor trustee or the current trustee. So trying to understand that they're completely different documents goes back to what you were saying, that fiduciary responsibility for different things.
Exactly. So the trust can only control, or the trustee can only control, what is titled in the trust. Early on in the show, I mentioned that how important it is to have powers of attorney. Well, oftentimes you'll have a financial power of attorney. That document, if you have a trust as well, is going to control assets outside of the trust. And it can be a number of things. It could be a bank account that is outside of the trust. It could be your tax return, your credit card debt. If you get sued and you cannot represent yourself, your agent under the power of attorney would represent you in that lawsuit. None of that falls under the trust. So what you're seeing, Jennifer, is two documents and two potentially different individuals. Sometimes they're the same, but the purposes are different. Mm-hmm. And if you have a trust and you have assets inside of the trust, the agent under the power of attorney does not have the authority to take over control. Mm-hmm. It's different purpose.
Yep. We actually have a situation that falls under this right now that we're dealing with, unfortunately, with an elderly lady who's just recently became unable to act on her own. She had successor trustees, actually two of them put in place, and they were co. And then if something happened to one acted solo. So unfortunately, she lost a daughter. So the son was the only one that was the trustee. But then another daughter sent powers of attorney and said she needed to get funds for her mom. And we're saying, well, I'm so sorry. There's no trustee that can act right now because your mom is still the trustee. We have to nominate the successor trustee. Well, he doesn't want to do it. Okay, then you got to go to the courts because there wasn't a next level. And it sounds like this is more of an urgent matter. So making people understand that those are two different things. They don't overlap. It was a little bit difficult for people.
It is. And the scenario you're describing mm-hmm. came up for me just a couple weeks ago, where the documents are different and they serve different assets and different purposes. Mm-hmm. And it's another good reminder on when you have these significant life events, a passing of a child or a spouse or a new addition to the family, it is good to review the documents, review your beneficiary designations, look at your successor trustees or successor agents under the power of attorney. Does it still fit? Because mm-hmm. if there is a deceased individual, then it's always a good time to consider a quick update to the documents, move the next nominated individuals up to first priority, and name some more successors mm-hmm. so that it is consistent and updated.
And so simple.
And simple.
Yeah,
very
yep.
simple.
All right, we're going to take a quick break and we come back. We've got a few other things we'd like to finish. We do have time for phone calls, so if anyone would like to give us one, we'd appreciate it. 580-KIDO, 580-5436. Good morning. Welcome back to Money Matters. Jennifer Stone filling in for Dave Petso today. And joining me today was the lovely Ariana Klopp-Youngren. She's with Sandra Klopp & Associates. If you would like to get in touch with her at her office, their number is 208-938-2660. They are in downtown Eagle. I guess you could call it downtown. I love Eagle. I live there, so they're right by the river. It's a beautiful location. So if you need her after the show, that's where she is located. We had so many things that we still want to finish up with, and we don't have a lot of time. So we're going to hit a couple brief things. I'm going to just let Ariana run with it and give her the signal when we're done. We'll probably do a follow-up on this at some point, maybe throw it on YouTube or do another podcast or something, because it's been so good and there's so many things to cover. But I'm going to be quiet now. Thank you all for listening and let her run with a few topics.
Thank you, Jennifer. A few things I thought of that come up quite frequently in my practice is joint titling on bank accounts. If you have joint titling on bank accounts between husband and wives, there's usually no issues with that transfer. But oftentimes what we see is if we have a child that is named as a co-owner on a bank account and the parent dies, the bank will tell the child, well, you're the surviving co-owner. It's yours. And that is not the case. And it causes an immense amount of frustration and trouble with estate planning attorneys and the probate process. Because if there is no indication that there was the decedent's intent to transfer this account to the child, that money comes through the estate and out to the intended beneficiaries. It does not go to the surviving account owner. So be very, very careful when you're naming children on those bank accounts, making sure that you be, you know, mindful of that rule. And the other item I want to briefly touch on, but I can talk about it for a long time if I had the chance, is gifting your assets to your kids, particularly your home. We will have clients that will add the child to the home, or they will transfer the home to the child, and it creates a number of issues. One, you are missing out on the tax basis step up when you pass away. Tax basis step up, meaning fair market value of your home when you die, becomes your new basis. It's a way to help eliminate or reduce capital gains taxes after your passing. When you transfer that home to your child, whether half or 100%, then that the child inherits your original tax basis and they have no basis step up. So again, there's many other issues we could address with transferring the home to the child, but just be mindful of that.
Yeah. Thank you again. This has been lovely. Again, we'll try to do this some way to get more information, Medicaid planning. There's so much to cover. So again, thank you. Have a great weekend.
Thank you.